We have 1.2 trillion carbon molecules in every cell. We have 30 some odd trillion cells, and that's us. So carbon is really a flow that just animates everything that we love, that we enjoy, that we eat, our children, all plant life, all sea life. Everything that is alive on this planet is animated by the flow of carbon. So much of what we lost, you know, we get the data that we've lost 73, I think, latest data of wildlife and mammals and animals in the last 50 years. Like, that's just, it's shocking, you know, when you get that data, but you don't know what to do with it. You know, what can I do? What can I do? And so I wanted to move away from the guilt, if you will, or the compulsion, because it doesn't work to talk that way to people.
Paul Hawkins starts ecological businesses, writes about nature and commerce, and consults with heads of state and CEOs on climactic, economic, and ecological regeneration. He has appeared on numerous media, including The Today Show, Talk of the Nation, Bill Maher, CBS This Morning, and others, and his work has been profiled or featured in hundreds of articles, including The Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and Washington Post. He has written 9 books, including 6 national and New York Times bestsellers. He's published in 30 languages, and his books are available in over 90 countries. He is the founder of Project Drawdown and Project Regeneration, which is creating the world's largest, most complete listing and network of solutions to the climate crisis.
His latest book is Carbon, the Book of Life.
Paul Hawken, welcome back to One Planet Podcast and the creative process. So the last time we spoke about your book, Regeneration, and your drawdown and other projects, and now you've just come out with this book that you'd mentioned before, Carbon, the Book of Life, which is, I think it's a special book for you. And before we dive into the conversation, I believe you've selected a brief passage to share with our listeners.
Well, what I thought I'd do, and hi, Mia, and so good to see you, is actually choose the first paragraph. It's so interesting because somebody asked about how do you write a first paragraph for a book, and it's actually pretty difficult because it's like, come in, and you want them to turn the page. And for a long time, just as a writer, this was the second paragraph. And then I looked at it, and I flipped it, and I said, no, this is the first paragraph. And so I'll read that paragraph to you. It starts with a quote from Baya Okomolafe, and it just says, there are things we must do, sayings we must say, thoughts we must think that look nothing like the images of success that have so thoroughly possessed our vision of justice. So that to me is a very important quote to precede the whole book, you know, to lead into the whole book. The first paragraph says, carbon moves ceaselessly through the four realms, the biosphere, oceans, land, and atmosphere. It flows in rivers and veins, soil and skin, breath and wind. It is the narrator of lives born and lost, futures feared and imagined. It is the courier coursing through every particle of our existence, the interwoven lattice that permeates cultures, lagoons, mines, grasslands, organisms, and our temporal life. Carbon's dance of life does not take sides. It's never right or wrong. It is a timeless path that endlessly unwinds before us. Like Ariadne's thread, the flow of carbon is a story that may allow us to escape the labyrinth of anxiety, ignorance, and fear the world bequeaths. Carbon's increase in the atmosphere moves in tandem with the loss of the living world. The Book of Life encircles what has always regulated climate, the pulsing living mantle we call Earth.
Oh, well, that's beautifully read and beautifully written. And I think some people come into your book thinking, oh, this is a book about carbon, kind of like thinking about this like a sequel to Drawdown. But this is a very different book. And I think those words flow, the dance of life, its subtitle, the Book of Life, I think that that really conveys the message that I got from it. It's much more than managing solutions that you've covered in your other projects and books. This is something about just appreciating this whole fabric and flow of carbon that runs through us, and not thinking about it in a negative way, but in an appreciative way of this miracle of life, this miracle of this planet we live on, the carbon that runs through us and in the atmosphere, but through all of life on this planet, what makes it so special and unique. Why? I believe this is the fruit and wisdom and knowledge of like some 13 years in the making, as I understand. What inspired you to focus specifically on carbon and its implications, but also this flow, this dance of life?
I think like everybody, I read and I listen and I watch, particularly about the environment, about climate, about the narratives that are put out into the world about what is happening, what has happened, what will or might happen, or almost surely will happen. And they're primarily based around threat and fear. They're primarily based on suppositional facts, which I wouldn't argue against, by the way. I think they're good. The science is really good. It's a narrative that has infused our lives, who care about each other, about our place, about creatures, about living here, about our children. But that narrative is one that basically is about less we do, about really blaming fossil fuel companies, for sure, governments and politicians, and obviously large corporations. And so there we are. And that's kind of the quote-unquote narrative. And then there are books, and I think Drawdown was probably the first one to really accomplish a list of solutions. Like, this is what you can do. It was always meant to be followed by regeneration. And the difference between the two books is vast in a way, because Drawdown was really about stopping emissions and sequestering carbon. So it was bringing it back home. And regeneration was about creating more life on Earth. And that's it. Regeneration is fundamental and intrinsic to every living organism, including every cell in our body. And I wanted to really introduce that as the pathway forward. Carbon, the Book of Life, really came out in response to the objectification of nature, of carbon. You know, like, there's carbon offsets. There's nature offsets now. There's nature credits. There's this idea that somehow if we can make the whole world of carbon a marketplace, and that people could go in there, and entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley, and somehow we'll use the marketplace as a way to, solve or fix the climate problem. And I put these all in air quotes, really. And what I wanted to do is sort of pull back and say, first of all, carbon's not a thing, and we're objectifying it as if it was a thing. Of course, it is one of the elements, so in that sense, but it is as if it was isolated, as if it was the bad boy, our problem child in our culture, in our civilization. We got to go combat and tackle and all those things, climate change. And so I want to pull back and say, well, wait. We have 1.2 trillion carbon molecules in every cell. We have 30 some odd trillion cells, and that's us. So carbon is really a flow that just animates everything that we love, that we enjoy, that we eat, that our children, all plant life, all sea life. Everything that is alive on this planet is animated by the flow of carbon. And so we want to see the situation we're in as a flow. Okay, where are the flows coming from, and why are we interfering with them? Why are we crushing them? Why are we killing them, for sure? But also to see the wonder, the awe, the astonishment of life itself. And to have that sensibility being the one that is the overriding narrative of us acting in the world, and what we do, how we live, how we talk to each other. Because unless we change this conversation about climate into something that's a conversation about more, literally more, which is more life, better conditions for people in terms of social justice, restoring so much of what we lost. We get the data that we've lost 70 plus 73, I think, latest data of the wildlife and mammals and animals in the last 50 years. Like, that's just, it's shocking, when you get that data, but you don't know what to do with it. What can I do? What can I do? And so I wanted to move away from the guilt, if you will, or the compulsion, because it doesn't work to talk that way to people. After 50 years, Mia, 50 years of climate being in the news and in science and in our schools, and less than a fraction of 1% of people in the world do anything about it on a daily basis. You say, no, it's true. He's like, how could that be? And this is civilizational, this is not like a problem, a national problem. It's not politics. This is a civilizational crisis. And for less than 1% to be engaged and do something means that our communication, something wrong with it. I'm not talking about the people are wrong, or the science is wrong, or the facts is wrong, but the narrative itself is not one that really entices people, draws them in, brings in everyone with a shared understanding of what we face and then what to do about it. And the first thing to do about it is to care and to feel that care. And I wanted Carbon to be the subtitle of the Book of Life, because it is really the Book of Life, and without which there is no life. And so, yeah, it was 10 years in thinking about it and seeing the success of Drawdown Regeneration actually only amplified, I felt, the need to have a different narrative out there that didn't exclude those narratives, but included a larger sense of self and the idea that our life, our soul, our bodies, ourselves are inseparable from the living world. They're not like others, not like there's a climate crisis. We are climate. It's not there's a biodiversity crisis. We are those creatures. We are those cells. We are that. And so that inextricability of human beings and life on this planet was something that indigenous people understood and do understand and have practiced forever, as long as they've been here. And it's something we colonists, we people who have been so well educated in Western science, have to really step back and look at is how did we create this world of duality, where we separate ourselves and think ourselves better, and that we can take and extract in the world. And so, yeah, I mean, it's not meant to be a critique. It's meant to be an opening to the fact that we may not actually know yet where we live. I don't think we've been taught about this planet as children. I went to school, went to college, served you, and we took the classes and read the books. I don't think we actually know where we live. And so Carbon was sort of like lifting a leaf up, you know, from the ground, and you see, oh my God, there's all these creatures underneath. Carbon's like that for the whole of the earth, which is open it up and look at, oh my goodness, you know, that's where we live. And it is just a miracle. It's extraordinary. And so that's what we want to enhance and save. When people talk about saving the earth, you know, and the earth doesn't need saving. It's we need to save our awareness. We need to reimagine who we are, and to each other and to all other living beings.
I think that that's so true. At Earth, if we actually look after it, it can save us. It can look after us as it has, even when we don't interfere. And I have to say, it's an inspiring book. And I didn't mean to, in preparation for this interview, I was rereading different passages, and I meant to be, studying. And I went out into a cafe and I was just reading, and it actually inspired me to write a story. I've never written a science fiction story. So when talking about we don't know this planet, something about reading about all the wonders on this planet, I just started writing a science fiction story, just as though you think it's Earth beings who've been away from this Earth and are coming back. But then we understand that they're in this story that I just made up off the top of my head, is that it's actually aliens coming to the planet, discovering the wonders of Earth. And they think it's amazing, but then they start talking about humans and they say, oh, well, don't mind them. Just don't try to get into them. But there's others. There's octopus and buffuses, and, you know, there's leopards, and there's all these other creatures and butterflies and bees, and they know how to navigate and they can see all these things. So you just kind of go on stealth mode. Just don't mind with the humans and you, the others, or the, as you say, indigenous peoples who kind of have a respectful relationship with Earth and appreciate it. So it was just a kind of thing. And I don't want to say, for me, it's a strange, I always usually write earthbound stories. And this one was like, as you say, coming to know and appreciate this world, this miracle that we live in. So I want to thank you for the inspiration. And I think if I'm any measure, that other people, they'll learn a lot, but it'll also inspire their imagination. And I think the emotions, the emotional connection to take care, you know, like, oh, this is wonderful. And you shine a light on all these wonders, talking about different ways of communicating or different ways of seeing. We always think it's us and we're so smart. Look at our big brains. But you just appreciate all these different ways of communicating within the plant kingdom and non-human animals and all the wondrous ways that we can only intuit. But if we think less of ourselves, we could begin to understand more. And I think that this book is a great gateway for that.
Oh, thank you so much. I agree with you that, in a sense, if we look at ourselves as visitors for a minute and then what would we think? And then, well, if we visited a favela where people are suffering and they're deprived, that's one area where we visited. If we go to the Amazon, to the headwaters and meet the Achuar people, we'd have a completely different sense of this planet. And those are very real things. But in between all that is like 3.4 trillion creatures. That's just creatures that walk and fly and buzz that are in constant communication. They're constantly communicating. Our education, Western European, is like, well, we had the brain, we can talk, nobody else can. Then slowly there's this thing, well, okay, primates do seem to communicate and they can learn. There's this grudging acceptance that other animals and creatures have consciousness, they can communicate, they can remember. And what we're seeing right now, Mia, is an explosion. There's just a raft of young, extraordinary scientists, you know, women and men who are going out into the natural world with and without, but instrumentation, bioacoustics, and recording and parsing and looking at the animal kingdom, the insects, and coming back with astonishing reports and science about snakes can identify different snakes. They have personalities. You're like, what? A snake has a personality? Mother bats speak a certain dialect of, they call it motherese for lack of any other description. They name their children. They warn them off, some of the male bats who are predatory, and beginning to understand that, in fact, every creature on Earth is in communication with at least themselves and others, and that we live on a sensate, conscious planet. And it's much more interesting to think about us as wanting to listen or to and appreciate all the voices instead of thinking we're the only voice, which is very lonely if you think about it, and that we're in charge. We're not in charge. We're in charge of one thing, which is destroying life on Earth. We're doing that, but that's not being in charge. That's being a fool, and nothing else is doing that. There is no other creature doing what we're doing. We're one of 8.4 billion different species. And we're the only ones decided to double glaze the planet and ruin life on Earth with our mining and our pollution and our plastics. And so, yeah, it's just like sort of stopping, you know, this book is stopping. Take a look. It's not my story. This isn't fiction. I'm not telling you know, there's some great writers who do that. I'm just saying, this is where you live. This is who we are. This is our brothers and sisters, if you can use pronouns for all the other creatures, maybe not. But the point being, it's our family, and our life depends entirely on the whole of life, not on technology, not on Silicon Valley, not on Elon Musk, not on lies and cheats and people who accumulate capital and money. You know, it's actually so much different, so different, so more exquisite than the world that we are confronted with when we open up the New York Times or the Guardian or go online every day and go, oh my God, that's happening. But what is also happening is people like you and others around the world, unheralded, they don't make the news, they don't make headlines and so forth, who are restoring life on Earth on all single level out of respect and out of love and of grief too, you know, for this seeing what is being lost and has been lost. And that's like, you know, I'm a Californian. I don't like the word fight, but yes, we fought. I was a firefighter and in the Sierras when I was a lad. And the one thing about the fires in California, because we're so prone to fires and always will be, by the way, but you go after the fire is over, you put it out, you know, it's just a black carbon landscape, right? But you go back in the spring and you see grasses and wildflowers and this just peculiar green color because it's so nourished by all the ashes of the grasses. And there are seeds, wildflower seeds, that actually can only break the carapace and come out and grow after they've been subjected to extreme heat. So when you get these fires, you know, you'll get plants you haven't seen for 50, 100 years, you know, flowers blooming and so forth. This is what's happening now. I mean, the earth is burning. Civilization is in an act of self-immolation itself, you know, it's killing itself. But underneath that is this extraordinary understanding of human beings wanting to regenerate, restore life on earth. And the action of it itself It's how you restore yourself too. So it's not just other, it's the same thing. And when you're there, whether you're a farmer, whether you're a forester, a mycologist, whatever it is, you are now the flow of life. It's the flow of carbon, and that's the book of life. And we just lost our way, you know, for the last 500 years, we being, you know, Homo sapiens, we've lost our way completely. And we're not going to solve it by some new technology. It's not going to do it. Technology is not leading us to where we want to go.
Yeah. I mean, at some point we're going to have to depend. I mean, obviously the renewable energy technologies that are working, they're in place. The simpler, the better, the more complex accounting of carbon budgets and carbon capture, you know, not the nature-based carbon capture of trees. We like that. But they might take as much energy or, so, you know, that's too complicated, I think. I always have to do research, due diligence on those things.
Direct air capture. You're talking about direct air capture. Yeah. The technology.
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes, you know, but of course, you regenerative agriculture, that's of course carbon capture too. And in its essence, it brings the carbon into the earth. So I'm all for that. You know, it's strange because you wear I guess you don't like to call it like a spiritual book, but I feel it was spiritual. I feel it inspires people to appreciate on that level that I think is spiritual. It's not just counting the carbon units and making us think technocratically or like, you know, scientists. It's awakening the wonder. And then another aspect of your life, you do offer these very direct solutions with the Project Drawdown, Project Regeneration, and you work with CEOs as well. I mean, how do you manage all of that? Oh, I'm going to work just to be effective and efficient or try, and then how am I going to speak in a more transcendent voice, something that touches us all when we don't know exactly how?
Well, you raised several points, and let me go back to the first one. A lot of people hope or believe that technology will basically save the day. What day that is, I'm not sure, but you know, it will be our salvation. And, you know, solar panels and direct air capture. Direct air capture is sucking the atmosphere down into machines that strip out CO2. It's 4 parts per 10,000 CO2. And then strip off the oxygen and get the carbon, liquefy it, and then pump it back, you know, into geological formations and so forth. The interesting thing about that, Mia, to me, is that it defies physics. I'm talking about fifth grade physics, sixth grade, seventh grade, not like I have some idea about physics. Physics has the first and second law of thermodynamics, which are, you know, energy is not, you can't get rid of energy. It's always here. It just changes form and concentration. In other words, energy goes downhill, goes from high potency to low potency. Okay. That's called entropy. So when you burn something, wood, coal, gas, oil, whatever, you know, you burn it, you get ash, right? And that's entropy. The energy has been released and you have the residue. So what we have in the atmosphere now is the residue of burning coal, gas, and oil, and wood too, but coal, gas, and oil particularly, and it's called CO2. And of course, and CO2 is a greenhouse gas. It warms the earth by taking infrared radiation. It bounces off the earth, and then it gets excited, the CO2, and then some of that bounces right back to earth. And so we capture infrared, kind of like the old analogy of a car with its windows closed, and in the sunshine, getting hotter and hotter inside than it is outside. So that's what's going on. The thing is, direct air capture is about sucking it in, about liquefying it and capturing it, liquefying it, and then get into geological formations. How do you do that? With energy. Which energy? Well, they hope renewable, but let's go back to that in a minute. But renewable energy causes entropy just as much. What does it take to create a solar panel the last 20, 25 years? It takes a lot. Same with wind turbines. Cure entropy with entropy. That is a physical impossibility. You can't make, it's like technology that'll never work. I mean, it'll work technically, but not in terms of the objective. And so we're treating the atmosphere like it's something we can fix. We'll just get that carbon out of there. We put it up there, we'll just bring it back down. How? The way you do it actually makes the problem worse. So I think that the beauty of the living world is it tells us what to do. The purpose of regenerative agriculture is not carbon. That's the outcome. The purpose of regenerative agriculture is to create more life in the soil. And more life in the soil creates healthier plants, more nourishment, more mineralization, more everything. More life is carbon. In other words, you measure it by the life by the amount of carbon. Okay, great. And so it does sequester carbon, but that's not the purpose. It's the outcome. And so we want to look at these things in their true scope of their meaning and their purpose and what they give to us. So what we've done for years and years, since 1920 really, for 100 solid years, is basically feed plants with NPK, artificial fertilizers, you know, artificial in the sense that we manufacture them. And plants do need NPK, of course, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium to grow. And so NPK, you surface dress it, and then you see, oh, I got green plants. Great. It's not great, because the way nature works is you feed the soil, and the soil feeds the plants. It's a very beautiful, complex process. A ryegrass, give you an example, I think it's in the book, has one seed of rye, in other words, that has 14 million roots in ground. 14 million roots. It's like, what? That's not possible. It is. And every one of those roots is connected with Haje to mycelia, to these fungal networks in the soil. And they're transacting. They're actually talking to each other. Maybe that's the wrong verb, but they're communicating. And the plants are saying, look, I got sugar. I'm out here and making sugar in the sunshine. And the mycelia is saying, well, we need sugar to live. We got some nitrogen, some phosphorus, potassium, some selenium. That's a rare one, but we have that too. And there's a transacting. There's 14 million transactions on one single seed of rye. That's why I'm saying we don't know where we live. Then go look outside. Go look at a hill. Look at a meadow. Look at a forest. Look at the grass growing in the cracks of a sidewalk. And you go, what's going on underneath our feet and around us is beyond comprehension in terms of its complexity and its intelligence. And mycelia, this a guy named Adam Askey at the Royal Society in London has been studying mycelia for years, and he's recording them because they make clicking sounds, just like whales make a clicking sound. Mycelia click. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And he's recording them, and he's looking at pattern recognition. The machines are looking. They're saying the same way. There's repetition in certain clicking, you know, like Morse code, right? And then he's parsing it, and then he's looking at whole sentences, and he's saying, mycelia are making sentences that are just as complex as Indo-European languages. Look, there are mycologists who refute his work, okay? That's fine. But what you can't refute is the fact that the mycelia are communicating, at least to itself. What are they saying? What is being transmitted here? What's the language? Because we do know that if the root is sending of a tree or ryegrass or a plant is saying, I need phosphorus, the mycelia, that communication goes out and they bring it from where they have more of it or where they have some of it. And so, like I say, every time you take a step on the ground, you're stepping on this amazing world. There's more life underneath the ground than there is above the ground. We see the life above the ground. I look at trees. I live in a forest. But there's more life underneath on earth. And so, again, it's just about this appreciation for where we live and how it works. And we're just on the cusp, I think, of a huge paradigmatic change in science where we are not objectifying the other world so much.
In my own research as a college student in environmental anthropology, I have been fascinated by similar questions of connection, kinship, and ecology as they pertain to the creation of ontologies of division and the subsequent disruption of them. My own work focuses on wastelands and apocalypses, places we've abandoned, forsaken, or ignored. In my senior project, I investigated abandoned strip malls, what they do when the bustle of people and cars cease, when they're sitting on the roadside with no one to care for them. It seems initially that these places are not worth much, that they're dead. There's nothing that describes a liminal space more than a place with no address and no identifiable features. But my work drove me to sit with them and notice them and take the time to figure out what they're doing. When you look closer, you know, there's a tuft of grass sprouting out of a crack in the asphalt, or perhaps the shadow of an old sign or logo hinting at the people that used to come and go from the stores every day, the things that came and went. These are the memories of connections that underpin how we think about the world today, which motivate us to work towards a better future. We know what we've lost. We've seen these interwoven strands be snipped away.
We've seen carbon come and go, and with it plants and people, and the mild summers of our childhoods, and the snowfall and the winter, and everything that makes each one of us really at our core. So in thinking about Paul Hawkins' book and about his interview, I was reminded of the work many people in the West still have to do to undo ourselves and extend our worldview beyond the immediate self and even beyond the immediate species into a context of communication which we simply cannot lose. And now, back to the interview.
Yeah, it's so true. Underneath the ground and also in our oceans as well, that other great mysterious part of this planet. And so it's so sad that when you think about we're denaturizing our soil and killing it, and because everything has to be made into an economic transaction in the human world. I've got this, what have you got? I'm buying, you're selling. But, you know, it's strange because the wonders of the natural world is that we were distinct from it. But what's wonderful in this communication that we can't quite fathom is that they have this intuition, this intuitive intelligence that seems to arise with a loss of a distinct sense of self. You know, it comes from this kind of collective. You talk about the soil, you know, the universe being one mind. And I think humans thought we were moving forward in the seeing ourselves as such individuals. But then when we're such individuals, we tend not to be able to hear the thoughts, think in one mind. I think that it's not advanced. I think it's like stepping backwards.
Well, we've been well-trained, well-educated into thinking of ourselves as distinct, separate individuals. And what I say, there's no such thing as an individual, only in comic books and Westerns. They don't exist in the human form and no other form because of, I mean, we have 40 what, trillion microbes in and about on your eyelashes, on your hair, on your fingernails, inside you. Without those microbes, you're dead. So to think, and are they human beings? No. I'd say, so what's a human being? And then every time you inhale, you're inhaling other microbes, by the way, and other viruses, for example, by the way, and all sorts of things that you're taking in that you cannot help take it in, by the way. That's part of being a human being, being alive, breathing, is to breathe in life in all sorts of forms and bacteria. And that is what's going on. It's just like the plant in the soil with the roots interacting with worms and other things and beetles, but also with mycelia, with fungal networks. We're the same when we're breathing. Walk outside, you are actually breathing in life forms every single time you inhale, inside or outside. So again, to recognize that, it's not something you want to, it doesn't change your life. It might change the way you see life, though. And that's what we're talking about in Carbon, the Book of Life, you know, which is like, what if it's this way? And so that the idea of honoring, restoring, regenerating life arises not from fear, not from a sense of doom, not from a sense of we're screwed if we don't, but from a sense of reverence and respect of self and other. And so that erasure of that duality, because when we say we're in a combat tackle and fight climate change, you know, it's just so silly because first of all, the climate doesn't care what we think. And it generally doesn't use male verbs, fighting, tackling, combating. For something that is actually perfect at all times, the climate is perfect. It's perfect. It's a response to our activity here on Earth. This is where the problem is, not up there. And so again, to start to have a way of seeing the world where that duality, you know, the objectification of making the world other instead of making ourselves the world, not in an egoistic way, but in a holistic way, in a gracious way, in a way that gives us a sense of awe and reverence is really what the Book of Life is about. And I mean, it could have been much bigger. You can go on and on and on. It wasn't meant to be. It just sort of like a peek in, you know, it's got 200 pages or whatever, but just to like, hey, what do you see? And I'm not trying to, in this book, solve the problem or have the solution or I know you don't listen up, you know, which is kind of like what you see or hear a lot. And it's like, no, I'm with you. And I wrote that after Drawdown and Regeneration because I felt like people becoming solutionists. You know, well, we just have to do the solution, instead of actually saying, maybe we have to change how we see ourselves in the world. And maybe out of that emerges activity and connection that has been lost. I'm talking about connection now, that how vastly, beautifully, complexly we are interconnected with all living life.
I think that that's so true. And it's through this rethinking, it's one of relationship and partnership and not ownership. If we just right. do that, then you're not going to be emitting so much carbon into the atmosphere. You're just going to be using your fair share, just enough, not everything you can get your hands on, as we have that sad history of doing. I have some questions now from one of our university team members, Sage.
How do you think incorporating carbon story, or the story of things both molecular or visible, contributes to the conversation of Earth's future? How do environmental perspectives shift when we decenter humans? And drawing from what Bruno Latour would characterize as the pluriverse, what advantages do you see to opening discussions of environmental justice, policy, and change to both the human and the non-human?
Well, that's a book. Or at least a thesis. By the way, Latour has a very big influence on my next book, by the way. So I really respect it. Bruno Latour. The answer to that one is, I have no idea. And I mean that not just casually. I just mean, like, I don't think we have discovered what is possible and potential within human beings as one of the species on Earth. What we do know is that we went way off track, way, 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 way off track in terms of our relationship to each other, for sure, but our relationship to the living world. So I have the same question. What's the way back? How do we get back to a species that lived in a way that understood that it was our sisterhood and our brotherhood and our with all other creatures and each other as the only way to live here in a durable, sustainable, ongoing way for thousands and thousands of years? You know, how did we lose it, and what's our path back? Those are really, really important questions. I mean, I share them. As opposed to Sage on the stage, listen up, everybody. I've got this way of seeing the world that is going to change everything. I've seen that. I've read the books, and I see it every day. I'm going, no, is there another way we can talk to each other? And for me, the book is just sharing as opposed to prescriptive. And that's the voice that I was trying to get to. You know, I can read more from the book from that voice, because we all have that voice. It's sure, it's my voice from my past, my experience, my history, my education, blah, blah, blah. But the core of that voice is the voice I share with everyone, and vice versa. You know, people feel so much grief right now. If they are educated and aware of what's going on, or see it and experience it directly, like LA fires and so forth, I mean, there's so much grief, right? And to me, it's like, if you don't feel grief, then you're missing something. Because grief is a direct expression of love. You cannot feel grief if you don't love, and love a person, a place, a family, a child, an animal, a creature, a bird. That love comes from our heart, and our heart is the one organ in our body that always tells the truth. Always. You can trust it. It will not deceive you.
When reviewing the state of the world, one might venture to say that we're entering an apocalypse or a dystopia. When looking at our current affairs through the lens of the end of the world, how do you grapple with existential questions of not only the human species, but of all species and things on this planet? And I know it's not a prescriptive book, but what gives you hope for a better future? And how do you think younger generations can work towards a regenerative lifestyle?
Isn't that the question? It's a great question. And first of all, I don't have hope. No, don't take that the wrong way. And the reason, because in my Buddhist training, it's like, well, hope is the pretty mask of fear. You can't hope unless you're afraid of something. And therefore you hope it doesn't happen, in a sense. That's the dynamic. And so for me, it's about courage, which is the heart, which is just like, seeing everything that we understand in the headlines and narratives about, you know, the end of the world and the end of life as we know it and end of civilization, saying, okay, got it. Now, what am I going to do? I don't want to stay there. I don't want to wade in that pond. I want to actually move forward and do what I can do, which is small. Every one of us is small. and know that we are going to, we are in, but we're going to go through an incredible transition as a species and as a civilization. And much of what we cling to and hold dear is going to be just brushed away. There's no question about that. And the idea that somehow we can continue to grow our economy is just so absurd when you look at what makes our economy, which is basically buying the living world, to selling it to the highest bidder, is what's going on. I mean, that's what's creating the basis for our consumption, our lifestyle. These we know, these facts we know, but I mean, the question is, okay, now how do we transition? And to me, I work on my neighborhood, I work on my family, I work on my home, and not because that's going to change the world, but because it changes me. And just in this book alone, there's a chapter called Paper Eyes. It's about butterflies, actually. And they have eye spots. Some of butterflies do. And this is the Mexican owl butterfly, which I've seen in Mexico. It's about 7 inches wide. It comes out at dusk. But it has eye spots that look exactly like an owl's eye. And now how it did that, who knows how a butterfly knew how to make an eye that looks like an owl's eye. But it's to defend itself from birds who look at it and go, ah, it's an owl, and then fly away. Now, that chapter is full of stories about dragonflies and other insects and so forth. For me, and the reader may be different, but for me, it's like, oh my God. And so ever since then, I don't care. It's the smallest little insect. I will not kill an insect in my house. Or I'll take it out. The scorpions come in when I'm digging outside. They come in and put it carefully in a jar. I'll walk a little away from home, but I'm going to put it right back on the porch and take it outside and gently put it back into the earth where it came from. And that's what happened to me just by gaining a much more refined and deeper understanding of the world of insects and pollinators. So I don't know that I have the answer to that question in an overlighting response, you know, but because I have the same questions. And I wake up with them, and I do a lot of research, I do a lot of reading, I talk to people, and those questions are vibrantly alive within me. But what I don't believe is that there's no top-down solution, because nature is not top-down. So even if you have top-down leaders, so-called leaders like right now, who are trying to obliterate climate change from the government lingo and from, you know, activity, it's still top down, whether it's top down ignorance or top down care. Nothing happens from the top. It's not going to happen at conference of the parties, you know, in Azerbaijan or in Brazil this year, or the biodiversity conference in Cali last year in Colombia. I think the great conferences, people get to meet, talk, share, learn. That's great. But that's not where the solution is going to come from. It's going to come from the ground. That's the grass, the wildflower, the seeds, and so forth, the ground. And when you're doing that, you feel like, well, okay, I'm going to do it, but I'm not making a big difference. No, but you are. It's the only way difference arises, is from community. So it's not just you. It could be your family. It could be your neighborhood. It could be sisters or brothers that you share with, that you are friends with. Every cell in our body is actually a community. It's basically a chemical experiment inside a little enclosure, right? With, I think it's 10 trillion atoms in that little cell in your body. And it's a big chemical factory. The cell inside is not alive. It's not alive. The cell as a whole is alive. That transition or that delineation, that's the source of life. That's the beginning of life, and it's community. And so every cell really, you know, basically like other cells, they have sensors on them. They communicate. Cells communicate, and they become 2 cells and 4 and 8 and 16 and so forth, you know, 500 million years ago. And now we are the outcome of that process. And so to accept in humility the fact that we can only change things when we are connected to each other. And that's community in meaningful ways. And it doesn't mean you shouldn't publish. Doesn't mean you shouldn't do science. It doesn't mean you shouldn't write books. It doesn't mean you shouldn't start NGOs or for-profit companies to address these issues. But you do it by creating community. And so each person is going to find a different way to express that.
Indeed, yes, that's so true. And I want to say I really appreciate that chapter, Paper Eyes. And I didn't realize how many species of moth there were and how effective I guess they could be as pollinators, because I love bees. But like, wow, now I really want to find out all about moths and, of course, butterflies, which we all adore. But anyway, so I love that. And just, again, your book is so full of wonders. But you mentioned two things there, and I want to ask you about both of them at the same time. And one, you mentioned the Trump presidency and, of course, the importance of public policy in making these changes. The other thing is, I do hope you could maybe expand a little bit on another completely different subject, which is your Buddhist practice. So you pick which one you want to talk about first.
Moths and Buddhists, probably the same. If you want to have fun, you know, if you're living in a place where there's moths at night and so forth, get a ultraviolet flashlight and start shining it around and seeing the beautiful patterns and glows on these that look like dark things, you know. And you put a UV flashlight on them that you can sell them. And lots of lepidopterists and other people love insects, you know, actually go out and use them at night. And again, it's that thing of like realizing they're there. You're like, oh my God, where do they come from and where do they go during the day? And, you know, these are the ones you don't see because most of the moths are active at night. They fly in jerky ways, you know, to make it harder for swallows and bats to eat them. That's why they fly in a jerky way. The ones who did that survived, and they're here today with us. In terms of my Buddhist practice, I would say that I spent time in Japan when I was young and temples there, and also in Bhutan. I would say my practice is just reverence, really, for life. I am not a very assiduous practitioner in terms of how I meditate and how often and this. You know, I have everything right there. It's in my meditation room.
Yeah, there's a beautiful painting behind you as well that I don't know who did it, but yes.
Yeah, it's from Japan, yeah. I think the thing about Buddhism in its classic and original form is it's a non-dual way of looking at self and the world. And that's what attracts me to it. And, you know, Christianity is, so is Islam and these other religions that came out of respect from their originators but have become really very dualistic. And so as Buddhism in many ways, look at the people in Myanmar, Buddhists, basically what they did to the Rohingya is just heartbreaking. So every religion can descend to deteriorate. But for me, Buddhism is simply about being simple and act, eat, walk, respect, you know, and being aware of each step, each morsel of food, you know, each person, each living thing, the respect and reverence for life all comes from, I think, being exposed to really great teachers, you know, in other countries.
And it's a sidestep, so I don't know if you want to ask, but I guess your Buddhist practice is something that we might all need in these kind of chaotic times, talking about the second Trump presidency, and you spoke about the denial of climate change, and it just what made what was already hard, as you know, being a climate activist, even harder. So I don't know what your strategies for going through these times when each year is crucial.
It's chop wood and carry water. You lead your life as best you can, as respectfully as you can, because it starts there. It doesn't start in Washington, D.C. Take and go where that takes you. You mentioned that consult to CEOs, just a couple, really. Well, actually, no more than that. But I didn't go out. I didn't go out with a sign saying, you know, willing to consult. I wrote books and gave talks and things like that. And so they've come to me, really. We have this idea that corporations are doing terrible things. They are. Got that right. But the people who are operating and running them, managing them, working within them are really good human beings almost entirely. But so you meet people everywhere, you know, that are not really living up to what it means to be a human being. And that's possible in corporations. But actually, when you go, they love children, they love their family, they care, they're very devout in some cases. And yet we basically demonize them, okay? Well, they just grew up into that, you know, from school and business school and Wharton and Penn and Yale, and ended up because of their leadership skills and their intelligence, you know, as the heads of corporations and so forth. What I find really interesting about that, not this issue, is that they themselves have had the same awakening, if you will, like, oh my gosh, the world is deteriorating socially, biologically, and they're vastly interconnected. They're not two different things. And they find themselves in these positions of power, you would call it power, influence, you know. And what's fascinating about it is they're not sure what to do. Quitting is easy. Buying a farm, taking the kids to whatever, that's easy. I mean, they have the money, they have the resources. Or do they stay? Knowing what they know, knowing what the questioner knows, or you know, and do the very best they can to turn that ship, whatever you want to call it, that corporation, quietly and effectively into something that's regenerative. And if you look at these companies from the outside, you go, they're doing this and this and this and this, you know, and I've had the same criticism. But if you actually get in underneath that, you'll find that the people just like you and I, and they do care. And they are in a system that they did not create that has perverse incentives, in my opinion, you know, which is to grow and create more money for people that own it from a distance that you never meet. And they're working with it because they've made a choice to stay there and try to see if they can make a difference. You know? And we read about the ones like the Rupert Murdochs and the ones who, you know, are entirely, entirely selfish and, you know, self-oriented and who are rich and influence things in a very perverse way. But we don't hear about the ones that are really, they're our friends. There are people that are, I respect deeply.
Yeah. I mean, we've had a few of them on our show from some of these big organizations. I mean, granted, they're the ones who run the sustainability initiatives.
Yeah, I'm not talking about that.
Not a greenwashing, no, but we've had a few good ones. And you look at the figures and, oh, well, maybe it's a drop in the bucket, but it's still a pretty big drop in the bucket, more than I've managed to convert into, you know, renewable energy from within a larger fossil fuel company. But kind of changing a mindset. So they see it from like making change from the inside. And so I've tried to open, we have to have conversations. So we have to talk, because if they feel vilified, well then, well, if you want me to be the villain, well, I'll just play the villain because I'm not being listened to. I can see that. Yeah, no, I completely agree. We have to have these conversations. And I think that Carbon, the Book of Life, is a great, I would say, conversation starter, but something that we can all agree upon, you know, and we can accept with wonder and grace. It just helps us appreciate, and that gets that emotional involvement. And then we can follow your other project, regeneration, project drawdown. We can do that other hard work, but it moves us along. And I guess I asked you before, those teachers, those mentors, those life lessons who were important to you, because you've devoted your life to this more than most people I know. So you, as you reflect on the future and the kind of world we're leaving the next generation, what would you like young people to know, preserve and remember? And I guess in parentheses, if you reflect on some of those teachers you've had and what you learned from them.
To anybody, especially youth, younger persons, so forth, trust yourself. Trust your gut, trust your sensibility, trust your sensitivity, and go where it takes you. Because sometimes where it takes you seems risky, or it's not what your parents wanted for you. It's not where society would like to slot you in. You know, you're bright, you're young, your mind is just working at probably the best level it's ever going to work in your whole life, and you care, right? But to trust that, because when you look at the stories of people who have really made a difference, they kind of peel off and did things that weren't necessarily approved or didn't make sense or were risky, and know that you're going to fail. Like, you will fail. And failure is the gift. Failure is a vast pool of learning for you. And your students now, you're learning, but that learning and that education is extremely formatted, with all due respect. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying it's extremely formatted. The learning that comes to you, the teachings that come to you from following that still small voice within you that whispers you at 3 a.m. in the morning if you're awake, or during the day, or when you see something or react. That voice, you know, which can be quelled by work and this and pressure and social media, blah, 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 blah. I mean, you know, that voice is, listen to it, feed it, and it'll feed you back. Because, I mean, all my work comes from basically going the wrong way. I'm serious. But what fed it, the basis of it, was curiosity. And sometimes education can really quash curiosity. I mean, deep curiosity, like the very questions that were asked today about curiosity, like, well, but follow that. To me, this book, Carbon, book I'm writing now, I mean, they're all about me finding out about the world, discovering the world, being curious, asking questions, going to people who are brilliant scientists or writers or activists, and listening, reading. And out of that comes a kind of my own zeitgeist, not the one that's common to the world as a whole, my own way of seeing the world. And then I act, and I don't try to act to be successful. I don't think about that. And that's kind of counterintuitive, you know, because everybody wants to succeed, of course. At least in terms of other people's respect or financially or academically or whatever. But that's fine. But just don't put away that voice that is whispering to you, that's talking to you, the one that went to the coffee shop and started to write a science fiction story. That voice is really important.
Well, thank you. Once I hear that aging is the process of becoming the person you are meant to be. It's that inner voice finding, I think, about curious about the world, we also come to know ourselves. So thank you, Paul Hawken, for all you do to open our eyes to this book of life and the beauty and fragility of this earth. By appreciating with humility the carbon within all living organisms, we can understand the reality of our kinship with the living world, regenerate the planet, and restore human connections with the rest of nature. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
Thank you, Mia. Thank you for all you do. Thank you for being you.
The Creative Process and One Planet Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Sage Shoemate with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producers on this episode were Sophie Garnier and Sage Shoemate. One Planet Podcast is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Music is written and performed by Juan Sanchez. We hope you've enjoyed the program. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast and be a part of the climate change solution, just drop us a line at team@oneplanetpodcast.org. Thank you for listening.